Survivor's Guide to True Crime includes discussions of sexually based violence and is not intended for children. Information provided should not be used as a substitute for professional medical or legal advice. Please exercise discretion and self-care. Welcome back to Survivor's Guide to True Crime. I'm Kim.
And I'm Kara.
Thanks for joining us back here again.
Yes, I'm glad to be here, Kim. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. I will never not see the SNL skits about sweaty balls.
Oh my God. Every time we do this, I see and hear those. That's it. That's my whole brain. Anytime I'm talking and you see like the vacant look behind my eyes, that's probably what's happening. Either that or I'm thinking about nachos.
Now I'm thinking about nachos. Thanks a lot.
I love nachos. They're my favorite food.
My parents have searched restaurant over restaurant, and I used to cringe, and now I'm like, my mom was on to something, because when she goes to order nachos at a restaurant, her go-to question is the cheese throughout?
Ooh, that's a good question. And I want to
know, you know, there's all those restaurants where they pile them high, but it's all chips, and it's just the stuff on the top, and she's like, is the cheese throughout? I don't know, is the cheese throughout?
Okay, so a friend of mine went to Guy Fieri's restaurant recently, mm-hmm. and they have like, I think he calls them like trash can nachos, mm-hmm. and they put them in like a little thing, and then they lift up the little tube, and the nachos all fall out, and it's all beautifully, evenly distributed.
Like those Barbie birthday cakes?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Except like nachos fall out and it's magic. Have you seen that trend that's like, it's that guy that has his own podcast now. I can't think of his name, but he was on Joe Rogan and he's like from Louisiana. There's a trending sound right now and it's like, if you had a wishing well and you wrote vapes in here and you came out there at night with a flashlight, you look down in there, I'd be there. I'm like, if someone wrote nachos and you came in, it would be little old Greg Kara down there going, drinking Bailey's out of a shoe, which if you don't get any of those references, I'm so sorry. We are not on the same side of TikTok because I also got a TikTok reference, like pops up on my For You page. And it's this woman. And she's like, I got these little toys from like TJ Maxx, I think, for my daughter. And it's like a lion and a tiger and old Greg. And I was like, oh my God, old Greg. I was like, I didn't realize the other, it's like this weird, what is it called? The Mandela effect, where I'm like, did that really happen? Was there really a whole ass video of this guy that lived, where did he live? Like in
the ocean swamp? Yeah, lake.
Drank Bailey's out of a shoe and he had a mangina. And it's like, was this a real thing that we actually consumed?
But I feel like that was that whole time period before YouTube was YouTube. And you had like E-Bombs World. And there were some like random offshoot.
And Smosh, right? So it was so weird. It was a bizarre time in the internet.
But do you, please tell me you saw the end of the world. The end of the world. It's like a video that is maybe 2 minutes long, animated, really crappy. And the guy's like, okay, so that is the earth. Dang, that is a sweet earth, you might say. Round, chilling. And it goes through this and like, folks, that's all we had to quote. If there are any youths here, that's what we had to go off of for years and years. And you just scream it at each other back and forth along with 2 to 3 Will Ferrell movies. That's it.
That's the I am le tired one.
I am
right?
le tired. I say that all the time.
You made me watch that because you were like, wait, you haven't seen this? And I was like, no, I don't think so. No. Because I was like a whole ass adult in college when those things were coming out. And I was like working and paying bills and... Yeah, like I actually had to pay my own bills. And I don't think I did.
I was working hard at Hooters.
Yeah, I was working at the sheriff's department.
Right. Yep. We were not the same.
So I would only see those random things like on the sporadic times when I would decide that I did want to babysit my friends who all wanted to go out and drink. And they would show it to me before they would all go out and drink. And I would stand around holding everyone's high heels with my RBF and get randos at the bar going, smile, sweetheart, it's not that bad. And then I wondered why no one ever wanted to date me in college. Like, because this is my face. And I looked like a total bitch. I'm like standing there sober, holding everybody's shoes and keeping my friends from disappearing into restrooms with random men. Like, why was I so unapproachable? I don't know. Anyway, that went hard, far, and right, fast.
And meanwhile, I'm just sitting over here with like, you're telling me a story and all I see is the kangaroo in Australia getting crossed out. fucking King Cutters.
Yeah. And now all I can think of is that video that I sent you from Brooklyn Nine-Nine, where it's all of the, that's the title of your sex tape quotes.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, that went hard, far, and right, fast. And I was like, title of your sex tape.
I know I can't watch Brooklyn Nine-Nine because I will binge it and neglect all self, family.
Dude, Terry Crews, he is bae. I love him. He is one of my favorite humans in the world, Terry Crews.
If any of you are listening to this and you have a connection to Terry Crews.
Oh my God, he's on our guest. He's on our top three guest list.
He's at the top of our wish list.
Oh, we love Terry Crews so much.
So much.
Okay, that went like, seriously, so off the rails so fast. But what else would you expect from us?
But let's bring it back here for a second, because today's episode is lovely. And thank goodness it was with somebody that Kara knew from ahead of time, because this was actually the first episode that we recorded way back in November of like 2022. But we've held on to it because we wanted it to coincide with something very special.
Yes. So our guest today is Avrimi Zipel, and he was writing a book. He was kind of finishing it up when we did this interview. So we were like, hey, listen, when we record it, just talk like it's already published and we'll hold on to it until your book is published. It's published. It is on pre-sale. So you can go to Amazon and you can buy it before it comes out now, and it will ship to you as soon as it is ready.
So we want you right now to go pre-order Avrimi's book. It's called Not What I Expected. And I promise you, after you hear this conversation, you are definitely going to want to read that, binge the entire thing all at once, because he is a wonderful human and doing incredible work. He was so well-spoken. Oh my gosh. I was just sitting here like, oh, with my mouth hanging open, listening to him talk. It was just a really great conversation.
Yeah, I think he is also someone that the first time I met him in person was when I went to Utah for the Maalouf Summit. And I messaged him and I was like, hey, I'm in Utah. And he's like, I'm going to come meet you right now. And all we did is we just like walked around this big gigantic square basically for like an hour and just talked. And it was just like, it's everything that happens when you meet someone who understands, you know, who like you have that soul connection with. And this is the survivor community. And we just walked and talked. I'd never talked to this person in real life before. And we're just walking around. And I was like, this is so cool. It's just an automatic connection. He's a lovely, lovely human who's doing great things for his community, specifically for the Jewish community in Utah. Like, you'll hear all of his accolades and everything in his bio in just a second. But he's done some really cool stuff. And this is just another step in the process for him.
He put up a video of himself last week, I think it was, opening the big box of his first run of the book. And just those videos, literally every time when you're following a creator or somebody who you know is doing important work and they open up that box, that unboxing video, it gets me right in the feels every single time, because like, I hope one day that could be me.
Amen.
And I just like it. Yeah, all of the feelings.
It's not unlike birthing a child, you know, the first time you see your baby and you're like, holy crap, I made this, you know, like I made this all by myself. Not all by myself, but, you know, books don't happen all by yourself. But I imagine it would be very similar, and just like the sense of awe and pride to see this book. And especially when it's something like a memoir telling your story, it's just like, wow, this gets to go and live out in the world. It's a little terrifying and a little awe-inspiring. And we just send all the congratulations and best of luck to Avrimi. And we hope that you'll go and support everything that he's doing.
Yes. I got some really cool swag from Brené Brown herself. It was very exciting. But one of the things was a print that hangs right behind me on my door. And I love this. And I think it has so much to do with those videos, but especially what Avrimi's doing here. And it's from her book, Dare to Lead. And it says, we are born makers. We move what we're learning from our heads to our hearts through our hands. And when you think about writing your book and having all of that move through your hands to that keyboard and onto the page, I just think it's such a beautiful reminder of all of our experiences come together to create this beautiful story. And so with that, we bring you chapter 13 of The Survivor's Guide to True Crime, which just makes me so happy.
Ah, lucky number 13.
Hey, hey. This is Taylor Swift's favorite episode because it's number 13. She totally listens, probably. I don't know.
Let me tell you a little bit about Rabbi Avrimi Zipel. He was born in Toronto, Canada, and moved to Salt Lake City with his parents in July of 92. He attended a Jewish high school in Chicago and attended rabbinical college in London, England.
Rabbi Zippel participated in Jewish outreach and humanitarian missions in Denmark, Germany, France, Italy, Wales, and numerous cities throughout the U.S. He was ordained at the Rabbinical College of America in Morristown, New Jersey, by the Chief Rabbi of Israel, Rabbi I.M. Lau, in December of 2013. He married Shana in January of 2014, and together they moved to Utah later that year, where they created Young Jewish Professionals Utah. They are the proud parents of two adorable little boys.
In February of 2019, Rabbi Zippel publicly came forward about the decade of sexual abuse he endured at the hands of a childhood caretaker. He's believed to be the first Orthodox rabbi to publicly speak about sexual abuse in his past. One of the things that Avrimi Zippel and I have in common is that we were both supported through our healing and public appearances by Elizabeth Smart, and that's actually how we met.
Since then, Rabbi Zippel has taken a leadership role in combating sexual abuse in religious communities around the world and advocating for survivors.
Rabbi Zippel serves this community as the crime victim representative on the Utah Council for Victims of Crime and was recognized as the Child Advocate of the Year in 2021 by Prevent Child Abuse Utah.
His story has been shared in numerous formats, most recently in Ali Raisman, Darkness to Light, a made-for-TV special that aired on Lifetime.
He's a sought-after lecturer and mentor to communities around the world.
In April of 2023, Avrimi's long-awaited memoir entitled Not What I Expected is due to hit shelves.
We think you will love and enjoy this conversation. And without further ado, here it is. Okay, we are here with my friend Avrimi today. Avrimi, thanks for joining Kim and I. Tell us a little bit about yourself and who you are.
Well, what's up, guys? Thanks for having me. It's a real treat to be with both of you. My name is Avrimi Zippel. I live here in Salt Lake City, Utah. And I think for the purposes of this conversation, I'm a survivor of true crime. I have lived in Salt Lake City my entire life. And when I was about 8 years old, I was sexually abused by a family caregiver, which was a dynamic that all told would go on for about 10 years. Obviously, there's a lot to unpack in that statement, and there's a lot to determine how that comes to be and why that comes to be and what could have happened instead. But it's been part of my life for as far back as I can remember at this point. Eventually, I would process that, press charges, come out the other side, have my story told within the true crime space. And now I get to live in a world where I look up to folks like the two of you who are doing such amazing work in that sort of universe for folks like me.
So our icebreaker question, what is the last television show, podcast, book that you binged, that you just watched an absurd amount of hours of or read for way too long, maybe irresponsibly?
Ooh, I know. That is a good one.
I know.
Breaking the ice.
I am more of a binge reader than a binge watcher. I can't do more than like two episodes back to back. Because if it's a compelling story, I want to actually follow the story and I want to process in between episodes. The last book that I binged, meaning that I compromised on healthy sleep values and probably gave my kids too much sugar so they'd stop bothering me so I could finish it, was the memoir of Mark Randolph. Mark Randolph is the co-founder of Netflix, who co-founded Netflix with Reed Hastings. And he wrote a book.
This is very meta.
He wrote a book called That Will Never Work. And the most powerful part of that book was how honest it was. And it was interesting because I read that right when my memoir was slowly taking shape. And I shut the book after maybe 8 hours straight. And I turned to my wife and I said, you know what? I want to have coffee with this guy. Now, I never plan on starting Netflix or anything of the equivalent. You know, if my AirPods work on a phone call, I consider myself a lucky man. I am not moving to Silicon Valley and starting a unicorn. But it was so honest. It was so real. Like, you know, it's a guy who started a $1 billion company who also lives life like a normal person. And so for me, I think just the honesty of it, the realness of it. And I wouldn't say there were any earth-shattering life messages, but it reminded me of how normal people are and how at the end of the day, the world is mostly comprised of normal people. One of the more memorable, like, funny moments of my childhood. I grew up here in Utah. The first glory days of the Utah Jazz, I was like seven, those two finals runs. And so there's a famous clip of the first time the Jazz played the Bulls in the finals, played Michael Jordan in the finals. Mm-hmm. And at media day, someone went to Jerry Sloan, the legendary coach of the Jazz, and said, you know, when your team is going up against Michael Jordan in the NBA finals, what do you think about? How do you approach that? Jerry Sloan famously looked at the cameras and he said, I tell my guys that when Michael gets dressed in the morning, he also puts on his pants one one leg at a time. And as a kid, I just thought that was the funniest thing I'd ever heard, right? Like, you know, pants and legs. And as an adult, I really came to appreciate that. And I appreciated kind of the mentality, like, you know, he's a human being. Guy's got two legs, two arms, you know, a bunch of ribs, like all of us. And we're going to approach him like a human being. And so I think for me, just the human nature of like such an incredible story, it reminded me of the power of storytelling and the power of authenticity and the power of finding your voice and all that stuff.
To your comfort level, of course. Talk about what was it like finding your voice for the first time?
I love the way you phrase that, Kim. And it's interesting. I was having a conversation literally this morning with a survivor that I was working with who was talking about going through the therapeutic process and how silenced they felt for a while and how it occurred to them how that silence was so traumatic for them because at such a young age, they had been told not to tell, not to tell, not to tell. You can't tell, you shouldn't tell, you must not tell, etc. And when you begin to heal from that, you have this power to you. You have this voice and you start trying to use it. And it's very overwhelming. First of all, it feels very unnatural. There is this great reel I saw recently. It depicted a survivor's guide to healing. And it shows a bunch of baby birds taking their first little journey out of the nest. And they've discovered that they have these very large things attached to the side of their body called wings. And if they flap their wings, they can fly. Problem is that it's not that simple. And, you know, and no baby bird has ever just like, oh, I totally got this and just, you know, flies off into the sunset. There's a lot of tumbling. And I feel like for survivors using their voices, learning that they have a voice, finding their voice, there's a lot to that. I have a voice. That's interesting for me because for very long, I didn't feel that way. I didn't feel like I had a voice. I didn't know what it must be like to have that voice. And so now what can I do? You know, let me try to use this. Let me see what happens. Let me see where it goes. I would describe that process for myself the same way in the sense that it was very unusual, very strange almost to discover that process, to be in that process and find that there were people that cared to listen to that voice. There were people that for whom that voice made a difference. There's a line that I always kind of circle back to in the fifth Harry Potter book. And we can go on all day, like, you know, how the Harry Potter books are so powerful for people who have gone through adverse childhood experiences. But there's this one line in there that I just want to, you know, blow up and put on my wall. And it talks about the fact that at one of the first Dumbledore Armies meetings, Harry's giving instructions to the crowd. And J.K. Rowling kind of puts this voice to his mind that as unusual as it was for Harry to be giving instructions to everyone, it was even stranger that everyone was listening. And I feel like for a survivor using their voice and finding their voice, that reality is so powerful in the sense that, well, hey, I can talk. So that's one thing to get accustomed to. And people will listen. Like people actually care to hear what I have to say. That's strange. And so I think it's a process that's ever evolving to really get down to the answer to your question. I think it's something that you don't really acclimate to. And I think it's kind of a balance that you find your entire life to realize the power that you have, to realize the value that you bring to that sort of conversation and to find a way to employ that properly for the rest of your life.
I love that so much. I do too. And you're in good company with Harry Potter fans too.
Harry Potter is a trauma survivor.
Yeah.
Harry Potter is a kid who from a very young age had his world turned on its head and then grapples with that for a very long time and has that reality called into question and spends a lifetime trying to figure out what to do with that. And I think the parallels are immensely powerful.
That's true. True.
I love that. And I think that so many people are going to hear what you said of not feeling like they had a voice and they're going to see themselves in that moment. And I feel like, you know, Kim and I share our stories, but they're obviously very different from yours. And I'm curious with the people that you interact with and that you're working with and talking to every day, if you feel that people who have been survivors of a childhood assault type of situation, if it's been your experience in speaking to them, that they tend to have more of that feeling that they don't have a voice in your experience?
So, you know, acknowledging the differences in the situations, I think there's something powerful there for childhood survivors. In most instances, people who go through this sort of thing as a child are suffering from that power dynamic. So we know that so many cases of sexual violence or violence of any kind against children is always going to involve a real dynamic of a power imbalance. And so one of the things that is absolutely inherent in that is that dynamic of, even if I'm going to speak up as a child, who's going to believe me? You know, I'm going to come out and say, you know, this adult has harmed me, has made me feel uncomfortable, has been inappropriate with me. That sounds delightful. Who's going to care, right? Who's going to listen? Who's going to take me seriously? I think that one of the most powerful things as it pertains to child survivors is the dynamic of, no one actually told us that we shouldn't tell. It was ingrained in us from such an early age. And in a certain sense, that notion of self-protection through a self-imposed silence is perhaps more damaging. I'll kind of jump to the end of the story. My case went to trial. It was a tough road for the prosecutor. You've got to explain to 9 perfect strangers how you have a loving female caregiver who does this sort of thing to a young boy for such a long time. You know, this is the case that really kind of flies in the face of the stereotypes that we have around this sort of topic. And so one of the really incredible things that she did is, I think she anticipated a lot of the realities that the defense would bring up and really made an effort to nip them in the bud and to bring them up on our terms and not on the defense's terms. And so one of the questions she asked at trial, and I made every attempt not to look at the jury when I answered this question, but my family and folks who were in the gallery did, is she asked me on the stand point blank, did she ever threaten you? Did she ever say, you know, if you tell someone, I'm going to, you know, kill your parents? No. Did she ever warn you not to tell? No. Okay, let's really get down to the bottom of it. Did she ever say, don't tell anybody? And the answer was no, because she didn't need to. And I think that that sort of self-imposed silence can often be the most traumatic of them all. I didn't want to tell anybody because it's not that I was told by an outside force that my voice didn't have value. I had convinced myself that my voice didn't have value. I personally had picked up the shovel and buried that voice so far down so that it would never cause me any problems. And I think if you do that, the process of unburying that voice becomes all the more necessary, but all the more difficult, because you've got to undo all of the stuff that you really did to yourself. And so I think it's a lifetime journey. You know, we all know that healing for folks who go through the sorts of things that we have is not short and it's not linear. And I think the reclamation of voice really fits in with that.
That's so beautifully and tragically stated how you said that too, because it does have a way of taking root and making you feel like you were digging your own grave, when actually the hallmark of predators is they know that you will do that. They know how to prey upon those grooming techniques and those faculties of what it is to be human and make you think that you did it to yourself, which just emboldens them to continue preying upon these victims, to continue having you operate in silence because you think that you put yourself there. And that's really common along a lot of traumas, any that carry that element of shame or blame. I mean, you look at something like Kara and I, where it's an absolute stranger, so completely separate from what you experienced. And when it's a stranger, you know, people think, well, obviously you're not blaming yourself, right? You're not going to harbor any guilt. It doesn't necessarily have to do with what the experience of the crime was, but all of the things that we do in the aftermath to keep ourselves alive, to keep ourselves functioning, to protect our brains. We internalize all of that as our fault when really it's reactionary to abnormal circumstances.
I love the way you put that, Kim. And I think for me, that was a huge part of the therapeutic journey in the beginning of it, was separating the two different things that were going on over here. So you have a decade of harm, and then you have everything that you as a survivor have done in response to that. And you have all of the self-shaming and the self-hate and the self-loathing and all the self-damage that you need to contend with. And I would make the argument that the recovery of the second part is far more intense than the recovery of the first part. Having to unlearn all of those negative behaviors, all of those unhealthy behaviors, and to acknowledge where they come from and why they are that way is lengthy. It's difficult. And you really begin to question your own sanity. I think for me, one of the most powerful shared experiences that I find with survivors across the spectrum of our experiences is that notion of, God, I thought I was crazy, right? I was convinced that I was insane. And to your point, I think that predators sense that and they manipulate that and they see that coming and they really know how to utilize that to accomplish whatever it is that they're trying to accomplish. And I think that process of asserting your sanity, asserting your being okay, asserting the fact that, you know, you made certain decisions in the interest of self-preservation, and now you can move away from that because you're not fighting for your survival anymore, is long, and it's hard, and it's ongoing, and it's something from which you truly benefit from constant reminders of what the truth really is.
And everything that you said is exactly why Kim and I want to do exactly what we're doing right now, because the more people share their truths and their realities, the more survivors will be able to hear those things and say, oh, I'm not alone. I'm not crazy. Someone's going to be listening to this right now. They're going to hear what you just said, and they're going to say, well, he's not crazy. So I feel the same way. I'm not crazy as well. So I think that there's so much healing in sharing our stories. And I think that sharing your story also is a way of reclaiming your voice. Like you said, it's a means of like healing your inner child.
Well, and I think that's the big departure, too, from what we see so typically in true crime, is you get the play-by-play of all the god-awful things that have happened and, you know, what's black and white on an affidavit or what was reported or what's in the headlines. But when we hear true crime as survivors, we know that there's so much more, because the real story that we want to tell and the survivorship is all the stuff that happens in that second decade that you're talking about. It's all the things that we now have to walk around with and that we are sentenced to life in. And those are the things that need validating far more than some splashy documentary or, you know, whatever's hot on Netflix or something like that. It's that there is a community that knows that the story goes so far beyond that.
I think the reason why the work that you guys do is so valuable, and I can relate to this, is so when my abuser was first arrested, my identity was not published at that point, and I wanted total anonymity from the process at that point. And I got one very valuable piece of advice, and that is, don't read the comments. Don't go anywhere near the comment section. Why is that? You know, forget the trolls for a moment. Like, you know, forget the people that literally their lives are so pathetic that they're sitting in their parents' basement just trolling people. But in all honesty, I think if you take a highly intelligent person who looks at my story, who just views it objectively from beginning to end, they will sit back and they'll be like, you know what? I have a lot of questions. And a lot of this doesn't make sense to me. And a lot of this is very misunderstood to me. And a lot of this, I feel like I would have reacted differently. I feel like I would have done something when I was 9 or 11, and I would have perhaps handled myself differently. What I would say to that is, you know, I appreciate that. And I'm not going to argue with that. But here's what it boils down to. You have the luxury and the freedom to look at my story and think about it from strictly an intellectual sense. There comes a moment for every survivor of crime, for everyone who's been through a traumatic experience, where survival techniques take over and they're not thinking rationally. We go through that. We react a certain way for whatever reason. Instincts take over. Something larger than us takes over. But then we're condemned to a lifetime of, you know, people putting on their glasses and having their 5 p.m. cup of tea and sitting back in their favorite armchair with our story in a brown manila folder and being like, well, I'm sorry, but I would have handled this very, very differently. And I think the notion is, great, good for you. You didn't have to walk a mile in my shoes. And I think there's such value to survivors being the ones to create the conversation around true crime, because we have that common bond of, don't ask me why I reacted a certain way, because I can't explain it to you. On a certain level, my story shouldn't make sense to you. What happened should not make sense. It is a non-plausible story, because at some point, instinct takes over and you're doing what you can to stay alive, and you need to live with that for the rest of your life. You need to live with the decisions that you made in the interest of self-preservation, but you can't judge me for that. And not even judge me, you don't have the ability to cross your arms and sit back and stroke your chin and be like, well, you know, I don't know why you didn't do this. And so I think that's why it's so important that survivors are the ones creating these conversations and fostering these conversations, because we come in with that prior knowledge. We understand the predicaments and the situations that other survivors have been through, and we can provide them that grace and that validation and that empathy.
It's a great way to say that too. Hey, Kara, did you know that April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month? Yes, of course you did.
Obviously, I knew that. But did you know that it's also Adaptogen April?
Say what?
Do you know what an adaptogen is, Kim?
I understand all of those words separately.
So adaptogens are essentially some type of compound botanical that goes into your body and helps your body deal with stress. It's non-toxic, non-specific, and normalizing. So what it does is it helps regulate your stress hormones and helps you adapt to stress.
I have some of that, the stress.
Yeah. The good news is that Cured, almost all of their products have adaptogens. So it's Adaptogen April, and they are really doing a push on education around adaptogens. And it is genuinely something that makes them extra amazing. My favorite products with adaptogens are the Rise, the Zen, and the Aura, but they are also in the Serenity Gummies. That's the ashwagandha that you see there. So if that sounds like something you would like to try, head on over to curednutrition.com. Use code KERATIN at checkout to get an extra discount and to support us, and let us know what you think.
My favorite platform to be on right now is Patreon, because I freaking love our captive audience.
Oh my gosh, me too. I think that the conversations over there are so authentic, so genuine. And honestly, because you're choosing to be there, hopefully you really, really like us and you're not going to think that we need to be committed when we are completely unhinged.
I love those conversations. I also love that we've got merch that's available over there and a bunch of extra video episodes. To be able to watch it and have that feedback from the folks who are there that make up our little Patreon community is just so much fun.
Like the real unhinged pterodactyl laughing and me just saying all kinds of weird things that Kim sometimes cuts into episodes. If you like those little kind of things, then you're going to like our Patreon.
But you also get bonus content, early access and news, and the input that we get from our Patreons really shapes what we are doing with this show. So if you're interested, please join us over on Patreon.
You can find us on Patreon at patreon.com/SGTC for Survivor's Guide to True Crime.
And you can find that on our website or in the show notes.
So when you talk about the trial process and everything that happened with court afterwards, one of the things I caution people about is don't stake your healing on the outcome of the justice system. More times than not, it may not work in your favor, just statistically speaking. But what was your experience like there? Did you feel well represented? And what were your major takeaways?
So first off, I completely agree with that assertion. And I consider myself fortunate that I had a glimpse into that from one of the earliest points in the process. So I first understood that the day that my abuser was arrested. So for context, there was a police investigation that unfolded really, really quickly, and the police caught a few huge breaks in the case, including a recorded phone call between myself and my abuser, and everything just kind of avalanched downhill. And so as it happens, she was arrested. I wasn't even in town. It was hours before Passover began. We were spending the holiday with my wife's family. And so I got the call in Northern California that my abuser has been arrested on suspicion of 130 counts of aggravated sexual abuse of a child. And like, you know, 72 hours before the arrest, you know, this was like the police were kind of taking the attitude towards this entire case of like, well, you know, maybe we'll do this. Maybe it wasn't something which they considered, I think, like an investigation that had any sort of life to it. And here we are 72 hours later. And so all this news is kind of washing over me quickly. And I'm standing outside my in-law's house, kind of taking space. So my father-in-law comes outside and he gives me this big hug. And he says, you know, I heard, how do you feel? Do you feel all better? I thought that question was sweet and genuine. And I turned to him and I said, no, I don't. I'll be honest, I don't feel even a little bit better. Like, and I had thought about this moment for so long, like, you know, and the click of the handcuffs, and, you know, and I'm assuming to myself, they for sure pushed her head down, like into the squad car, like as it's depicted on TV. And at that moment, all the birds will be chirping. And it's like, no, it didn't do anything for me. And that moment taught me a powerful lesson. That moment taught me that the outcomes of the judicial system, what cops and prosecutors and judges and advocates can do, has got very, very little to do with your internal healing process. So that's the short answer to the question. I was blessed to have remarkable representation. I feel like, you know, the local DA's office here in Salt Lake County handled the case with dignity and respect and followed my lead and really wanted to fight for my interests. And I was represented by an amazing group of people. And Kim, I know that you have a little bit of personal proximity to DA's offices. And I will say that if there's one thing that I learned throughout this process, it is that folks that work in DA's offices are the Lord's messengers here on earth. These are people that you never hear from, you never see. Their names will be in the paper about three times a year when they make a decision that is highly unpopular with the general population. And you never know the good work and the dedication and the selflessness that goes into the regular rank and file cases they prosecute and the closure that they bring to the family. So, you know, I'll end that rant right there. But one of the most valuable things they gave me was that notion. Do not hitch your healing to this process. You go heal outside of the district attorney's office. You go do that in your therapeutic setting or wherever else that you find healing. Do it there. Do not expect to find a wholeness of your soul in these walls. We will fight for an outcome. We will fight for justice. Justice is not necessarily going to provide the balm and the antidote for what's ailed you forever. And with that in mind, we still fought for it. We still pushed forward. I feel like I was given a healthy perspective throughout the process of what I was really after and how I could get that. And simultaneously, on a parallel track, I tried to find healing and justice in my life, you know, in the more therapeutic setting. So I think the most interesting part of the story is the district attorney filed 7 felonies against my abuser. She was found guilty on all 7. She's doing somewhere between 25 and life at the Utah State Prison. And as I think about it, I could not be more grateful for that outcome. And I'm grateful for the work that went into the case. And if I really think about it, all I want is an apology, which I've never gotten, which, you know, and presumably will never get. And it's funny when you think about it, that it's kind of interesting how those priorities are aligned for a survivor, you know, what we're really after at the end of the day. And so it's been an educational process for sure.
So you mentioned how you have found healing outside of judicial process. And I would like for you to talk a little bit more about what that process has been like for you, what your healing journey has looked like, and kind of where you are now.
In a certain sense, I'm blessed that my healing process has been relatively boring in the sense that I went to see a therapist for the very first time, and I'm blessed to have him in my life still almost 7 years later. Same guy. I see him a little bit less frequently than I did in the very beginning, but it's been straightforward in that sense. And I know for so many survivors, that process is so long-winded and curvy and, you know, up and down and back and forth. And I'm grateful for that. And so what that healing process has looked like for me, as I think back to the beginning of it and how that kind of set the tone all the way through, I think about some of the big acknowledgments that needed to happen in the beginning. Number one, I went to therapy a couple years after having my knee surgically repaired. It was like my first medical foray. And I broke my leg playing basketball. I shattered my patella and I needed to have surgery. And I met my orthopedic surgeon, who was a delightful man. I did a great job, sent me to physical therapy, and I had my post-op at about 6 months. And he's like, you know what, bud, have a great life. And I like this guy a lot. And I did not intend to have any sort of long-term relationship with him. Like, you know, he did a great job. And I'm probably one of the thousands of patients that he sees a year. And sayonara. I approach therapy the same way. Yeah, I'm going to go in to see this doctor, you know, maybe some books, maybe some pills, like see him a couple times the first few weeks. And at some point, I will likely get a doctor's note that will say, you know, I, Dr. Coles, hereby ascertain that Remy Zippel is fit to lead a normal life, and I wish him all the best, and I'll never see him again. Because childhood trauma is like knee surgery, right? Like, you know, we clean up the affected area, we put some stuff back together, whatever it is we got to do, we do, and off we go. And that first acknowledgement was huge. Like, that's not going to happen. And that is a wholly inaccurate way to think about this process. So the first big acknowledgement is you're going to be dealing with this forever. This is going to be your reality forever. There's not going to be a point in time where all the king's men were going to put Humpty Dumpty back together again, and you're patched up and you're good as new. Go out there. That's number one. Number two, connected to number one, is that acknowledgement should not diminish from your ability to lead the most beautiful, fulfilling, incredible life possible. So you are a survivor. You're going to be grappling with that. You're going to be accepting that. You're also going to have an incredible life. And you can involve the fact that you're a survivor in that life to your desire, to your choosing. Either you can make it a regular conscious part of your life or you can't. That's up to you. And I think the last big acknowledgement, which happened later on, is that one of the greatest things that you can do in the interest of your own healing is bringing healing to others. And that goes back to the point, you know, we're discussing about finding your voice. There's so much beauty in that, and there's so much healing in that. And there's such a potential for putting yourself back together to a certain extent in a way that you could have never imagined. I would say that on a certain level, I still grapple with all those acknowledgments, right? Those are things that require regular validation, regular clarification, regular acceptance of. Those are facts that I need to reinstill in my life on a regular basis. I think as the process goes along, you couple with that doesn't make me weak. That doesn't make me inferior. I think battling a lot of the stereotypes around male healing in that sense. Healing is, I think it's simpler than a lot of people think it is. I think it's reminding yourself of constant truths over and over and over again. I think a lot of people expect a big breakthrough. There's going to be that one therapy session where you're going to hear that idea or read it in a book or see it on Instagram. And that's extremely overrated. I think that casting all of your hopes and dreams on that reality is misguided. It's simple work. It's basic work. And it's just very repetitive. For me, that's what the journey is. I was on another podcast a couple months ago, and I had shared my story with somebody, and they said to me afterwards, they said, you know, thank you for sharing. I would tell you that I believe you, and I appreciate you sharing it, and that it wasn't your fault, but you've probably heard that enough times for a lifetime. And I looked over at this person, and I said, you want to know something? I haven't. And the reason why I haven't is because I'm 31 years old right now. I started going to therapy almost 7 years ago. I lived in a certain headspace for about 18 of those 31 years. I have so much undoing and so much repetitive work to undo so many negative perceptions that I have of myself, that you can never say that enough times to me. You can never say, I believe you, enough times to me or to any survivor. Like, I'll be 85 and old and hunchback, and I still want to hear it. And so for me, that's kind of the attitude. It's repetitive, it's relatively straightforward, and it's constant more than anything.
Sorry, I'm geeking out. I'm having trouble finding words, because anyone talking about the power of being believed, you can't say it enough. You can't hear it enough. The more and more we put this out into the world, the better off we are as a community, as a culture. Just, I loved the way you said it. And yep, that's all. Kara, go. She's very happy. Okay. So tell us about, you mentioned memoir. Tell us about this process. You wrote a book. Tell us about it.
So in the lead up to the trial process, about 2 weeks before trial, I was having a drink with someone who was very close to me at that point and was intimately involved in the whole process. And I was venting about how ridiculous the process is. And they turned to me like, you know, when all this is done, you should write a book. And I said, absolutely. I'm going to climb Kilimanjaro, and then I will probably cure the common cold. And then I'll write a book. Like, you know, I will do all of, like, sure, I'll write a book. What a ridiculous idea is that? And it literally was a joke to me. And then another person said it like a couple of weeks later, and then another person said it. And I think circling back to the point of finding your voice, I think for me, the weirdest thing to wrap my mind around was, why would I write it? No one's going to read it. Like, who's going to read it? Like, my wife? I'll tell her the story one night. I'll sit her down at the dinner table and I'll tell her. She lived through it, for goodness sakes. Like, who would care? And I think that process of discovery that, you know, your voice has value, your story has value, that there are people there that it could help, is really the big hill to climb. And it's the big kind of boulder to get over. And I think once you do that, and once you're given to understand that, that's the hard part, right? The writing it is relatively much, much, much easier. Just kind of putting it all on paper. I will say putting it all on paper and taking the time to think through it and organize it and do all those things was incredible. So healing. It was so powerful. It was meaningful. And honestly, it filled me with gratitude more than anything, just to think back about, you know, the absurd nature of what had happened and that, you know, that I'm at this point in my life. And I think that process of realization that there's value to your story that you can bring to other people, that's the win. Once you get that, everything falls into place.
I'll read it. Just throwing that out there. I'm looking forward to it.
I will send you a copy. Due out pretty imminently at this point, and I'm excited. I'm excited. You know, it was an incredible process, and you know, more than anything, I'm excited to see where it goes. You know, it is surreal. All of this is surreal, and I remember the steps in the process, and you know, the cover, and getting the first copy of the manuscript, and it's like, what even is real life? Like, you know. But, you know, it's awesome in that sense. And you go through it and, you know, you just kind of let it take you where it takes you.
Well, this is going to be really great to promote too. I mean, we are happy to put out as much information on it as you'd like. I know that a lot of listeners would learn a lot from you and find solace in the way you speak about being a survivor too. So that's exactly the kind of thing that we need more of in the world.
I appreciate that, guys. Thank you.
Of course. And I definitely agree. There's like this moment in the process and you're like, why would anybody listen to what I have to say? Like, who am I? I'm just a person. And you have to just kind of remind yourself that, yeah, stories matter and what you have to say matters and people want to listen to it. And I think just to second what Kim said, I can guarantee there will be people that will be listening to this right now and they will say, I really like the way he speaks and I like the things he has to say and I want to know more about him. And so we hope that we're able to send some people your way.
I appreciate that. You know, it's going back to the icebreaker question about the human element of life. So there are a lot of people that have been a big part of this journey. Elizabeth Smart is definitely one of them that comes to mind. And one of the, without a doubt, weirdest parts of this process has been getting to know someone like Elizabeth on a human level. Like, she's raising her kids. Her kids are roughly the same age as mine. And, you know, she's got PTA and soccer practice. And like, you realize the power of storytelling. You know, you realize that human beings that seem to just be celebrities, and they really are, but every celebrity also just wants a coffee and a nap and, you know, is trying to get to their kids' soccer practice with the kids' shoes on. And you understand what I'm saying? Everyone's yeah. just doing this thing called life. And we all have value to add. We all have value to add to somebody else's story, to somebody else's life. We're all doing the best we can. We're all human to a certain extent. And for me, realizing that and having a presence like that in my life was so powerful because there is a celebrity status there. And there's also a human behind that that you get to know. And you realize that we're as big as we want our stories to be. Our voices are as loud as we're prepared for them to be. And the sooner we lean into that and the sooner we realize the value that we can add to somebody else, the better off we'll be, in all seriousness.
Well, tell us a little bit more about where we can find you, where our listeners can follow up and learn more.
So I am on most social media platforms at Utah Rabbi. Well, when I say most, it's Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. I tried to be a good father and I decided that TikTok was way too time consuming. And so I decided to leave that to the people who were better off at it. Kara's a huge role model. But on social media, you know, for me, one of the things that I have always prioritized is I want to be the sort of person that answers every DM. For me, that was as my story grew and as there was the desire for that accessibility, that was always something which was important to me. And so I consider myself fortunate to connect with survivors literally every single day across, you know, social media. And there's an email address in my bio. And I have found such inspiration from people that have shared their stories. And one of the remarkable things is people will share their stories in an effort to try and ask you something. And you'll be like, I don't know what you're trying to ask me. I just want to let you know that your story is one of the most remarkable things that I've ever heard. And so I appreciate that you've initiated this conversation because you feel like I can add some value to your life. Because currently I'm in the headspace where it's bang the other way around. You know, reach out. We're all in this together. I think we're all doing our best and we're all helping each other grow.
And that's how you and I connected. Well, partially because of Elizabeth, but partially also because of social media. And I think that it's such an interesting and wonderful tool to have in our hands where you can impact the lives of other survivors on a very real level. Because the same as you, I want to be the person that answers all of my DMs. And if I don't have time for it, it sits there unread until I do have time for it. Because you do get a lot of people sharing their stories and your vulnerability and your authenticity will inspire other people's authenticity. And so I just kind of encourage you to just keep going and keep that up as long as you are able to do that, because healed people heal people. You know, it's cliche, but you have an impact and you have a voice and your work is important.
I appreciate that. You know, I think that's what it boils down to is I want to be part of the solution that manifests itself in a number of different ways on a number of different days. And whatever that looks like today for this situation, for this particular instance, you know, I want to help. I'm fortunate for those that have come before. And I feel like life at the end of the day is being the person to make the decision to pay that forward.
One last thing we want to ask you is, do you have any calls to action that you want to leave listeners with if they want to get involved with what you are doing or if they want to give back to what you're doing in some way, shape, or form?
I'm going to keep it really simple. One of the things that I actually really talk about in my book is throughout the process, there were just these small, innocent moments that were lifesavers along the process. They were texts, they were emails, they were DMs, they were people smiling in the hallways in the courthouse who had no idea why I was there. But you know, you figure you see someone in the courthouse probably not having the best day of their lives. And I think that for me, the call to action is going to be, there's always the text that we thought to send, we just didn't, because like, is it really necessary? Like, they probably know how I feel. Like, you know, they probably know what I'm going to say. And I consider myself to be a beneficiary of so many people who shared that text, who, you know, who wrote that email, who made that call. And so for me, the world is an ecosystem of good people doing good things and passing along that goodness to those that need it, and on it goes. And so I think my call to action would be the person that sends that text, be the person that drops that comment, that, you know, supports that initiative, that is that person for others that you know you've benefited from in your own life. And going back to, you know, the idea of, you know, that I believe you, there's never enough goodness we can share in the world, specifically with those that have gone through so much in their own journey. And so be the person to send that text, be the person to send that email, make that call, take those 30 seconds. It really changes lives.
I love that. I love that so much. And it's just been so great talking to you. And I feel like you just have so much wisdom and so many things that people can just learn and harness that positivity. And we are just so glad to know you.
Thank you, guys. It's been an honor. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Survivor's Guide to True Crime is hosted and executive produced by Kimberly Corbin Rourke and Kara Robinson Chamberlain.
If you love what we do here, please don't forget to follow, rate, and review the show in your podcast player. It's an easy and free way to help us and help more people find the show.
To learn more about the guests featured or to find resources and information discussed on the show, visit survivorsguidetotruecrime.com.
Thanks for listening.
Well, see you later.
No show. I want regular ass socks.
Found some.